quality results. Feed them a thesis, watch their wheels turn, and then out pops a set of photocopied, organized, and annotated notes. Their system ensures that the quality of their research is sufficient to fuel a standout paper and at the same time requires the minimum amount of time to achieve this goal. Sounds pretty cool, right? But how does it work? Their system is based on these four steps. 1. Find sources. 2. Make personal copies of all sources. 3. Annotate the material. 4. Decide if you're done. If the answer is no, then loop back to number 1. That's it. The devil, of course, is in the details, so let's take a closer look at what each of the steps entails. 1. Find sources. There are two types of sources, general and specific. As described in step 2, the former include overviews of your topic, i.e. biography or textbook, whereas the latter focus on specific arguments, i.e. a journal article or book about a specific event or idea. For a college-level paper, most of your best information is going to come from specific sources. The hard part, of course, is finding them. There are two strategies that can help you accomplish this goal. The first is stolen straight from step 2. Start with general sources and then look in their bibliographies for more targeted resources. As David, a straight-A student from Dartmouth, says, "Once you have 2 or 3 materials that you like, it's all about the bibliographies. Find out where the author found the fuel for his arguments and go check those out." In step 2, I suggested that you ask your professor or browse the course reserve shelf to find some of these general sources. Another place to look is your library's online card catalog. This sounds obvious, but using an online catalog correctly is not a trivial task. Just typing in keywords might not turn up every book that deals with your topic of interest. You need some more advanced tricks. One such trick is to take advantage of the Library of Congress, LOC, topic classifications. What are these? The Library of Congress tries to classify all books into one large hierarchy of topics. For example, Heinrich Harrer's fascinating book, The White Spider, an account of the first team to ascend the infamous north face of the Eiger Mountain, is described by the following 2 classifications. 1. Mountaineering, Switzerland, Eiger, History. 2. Eiger, Switzerland, Description and Travel. When you find a book in an online card catalog, its corresponding LOC topic classifications should be listed. The cool part is that these topics should also be hyperlinked. That is, if you found an entry for The White Spider, you could click on Mountaineering, Switzerland, Eiger, History to return a list of every book in the library under this classification. Therefore, if you find one general source on a topic, then you can easily find many others. And once you have found general sources, you can turn to their bibliographies to find something more specific. The second strategy for finding specific sources is to search for them directly. This approach is important. Not every specific source relevant to your thesis can be found in the bibliography of a general source. This is particularly true for more recent scholarship. Books take a long time to write. If a paper was published only within the last few years, it is probably too soon to find a general tome that cites it. The problem here is that specific sources can be difficult to find. For example, continuing with the Eiger topic, let's say your thesis within this topic is "The many failed attempts to ascend the north face of the Eiger played an important role in the development of Swiss cultural identity during the first half of the 20th century." Finding a general source about the Eiger, such as The White Spider, is easy enough. But finding a targeted source on the impact of the Eiger on Swiss cultural identity will be significantly more complicated. Simply typing "the impact of the Eiger on Swiss cultural identity" into the library card catalog probably won't turn up many hits. So, how do you locate these elusive specific sources? There are 4 main search tactics. Search tactic number 1. Break up your query into general chunks. If you can reduce your specific query to a group of related yet succinct general searches, you will have a much better chance of finding a relevant source. Following the Eiger example, you might try Alpine Hiking Switzerland Culture Switzerland cultural identity, alpine hiking, mountaineering Switzerland. Any one of these more general queries could turn up a source that either directly references your thesis or makes a point that supports your thesis. With practice, you will get better at constructing these general probes aimed at illuminating a specific idea. Search tactic number two, use journal databases. As mentioned, specific sources are more likely to be scholarly articles than books. Your library card catalog does not index articles. Therefore, as Chris from Dartmouth recommends, you should consider article database searches like JSTOR on the specific topic. How do you find these databases? Your library website should contain a list of available electronic resources. At some point during your freshman year, you will probably be given an orientation on this topic. Even if you sleep through it, as most of us do, it shouldn't be that hard to figure out. This list of resources is usually broken up by academic concentration, i.e., political science, anthropology, and so forth. Go to the concentration relevant to your paper, and you should see a list of searchable archives. Many of these resources will be databases of scholarly articles, so search these focused databases using the general search term chunks described in the preceding tactic and see what pops up. If your topic is interdisciplinary, meaning that it draws from multiple academic concentrations, follow Chris's advice and try a big database like JSTOR, www.jstor.org, which contains scholarly articles on a large variety of academic topics. Search tactic number three, when in doubt, Google. Google is your friend first and foremost, says David from Dartmouth. This is good advice, as Google is a great tool, but it should be used with some caution. A good rule of thumb is, don't cite websites. Academics don't trust them. Journal articles go through extensive peer reviewing before they are published, and academic books are written by experts and rigorously edited. On websites, however, anything goes. Therefore, they're worthless in terms of supporting an argument. Referencing websites is something you do in high school. If you do this in college, be prepared to experience the wrath of your professor. This being said, Google is still immensely useful. Not for finding websites to cite, but for finding websites that reference books and articles relevant to your thesis. For example, a search for Uyghur and Swiss cultural identity might actually turn up some websites dealing with or related to this obscure issue. The Google search algorithm is a lot smarter than the one used by card catalogs, so even very complicated queries can turn up surprisingly accurate results. If you're lucky, some of these websites will mention specific sources, a book name or article title. Now you can look up these in your card catalog and then treat them like any other formal source. Search tactic number four, ask a librarian. Most college libraries are staffed with reference librarians who want nothing more than to help you find the information that you seek. It's what they're paid to do, and they're great at it. Too many students, however, ignore this wonderful resource. Here you have experts who can save you hours of struggle by conducting advanced searches on your behalf, yet most students never think to take advantage of the opportunity. Making a visit to the reference desk should be one of your first steps when researching a challenging assignment. Simply explain your topic and thesis to the librarian, and he or she will walk you through several searches. Not only will this identify some specific sources that you may have otherwise missed, but it will also expose you to new library resources and databases that you can now use for future projects. The more time you spend with reference librarians, the better you will become at finding solid material on your own. 2. Make personal copies of all sources. How you handle the sources makes a big difference in the overall efficiency of the paper writing process. Though there are many ways to deal with the book chapters and articles relevant to your research efforts, many of the straight-A students interviewed for this book favored the following strategy. Make a photocopy or printout of all relevant material. If you find a book that has two chapters related to your topic, photocopy those two chapters. If you find an important journal article, photocopy the entire article. If you find an article online or a relevant website, print it out. The goal is to create your own personal hard copy of all sources. The advantages of this approach are numerous. First, these hard copies are portable. It's easier to carry around a stack of photocopies than a stack of books and journals, so you can take your research with you to your secret study spots or office hours. Second, the information is more accessible. No flipping through big tomes or searching your computer hard drive. All the relevant information is stored in one condensed stack. You can now physically organize your sources, for example, by putting them into piles by author, clustering relevant arguments together with paper clips, or dividing them into folders labeled by subject. As Sean, a straight-A student from Yale, explains, it's often easier to grasp something when you have a hard copy in front of you. Third, you can mark them up with impunity. Printouts and Xeroxes of source info are often superior to books or digital copies, explains Christine from Harvard, since you can annotate them to death. Feel free to underline things, highlight, draw arrows, cross out sections, or put big stars next to important points. In general, this approach maximizes the control you have over your information, ensuring that your sources work for you. However, there are a couple of important caveats to remember. First, make sure you label each photocopy with all of the information needed to later construct a formal citation. For example, if you photocopy a book chapter, jot down on the first page the name of the book, the author or authors, the publisher and its location, and the copyright date. Or, if you prefer, follow Christine's advice and simply make a photocopy of the title and copyright info as found in the front of the book, so you can use it later while constructing the work cited for your paper and ensure that you don't find yourself running back to the library at the last moment for citation info. Second, photocopy each source's bibliography. This way, if you come across an interesting reference in one of your photocopies, you will have easy access to the full citation attached to the reference. For articles, the bibliography is almost always listed immediately following the article. For books using the EndNote format, you might have to flip to the back to find the bibliography for a specific chapter. 3. Annotate the material. Finding a source, of course, is just the first step. A stack of photocopied pages is worthless if you don't know what information it contains and how it might be useful to your paper. You need to review the sources and annotate them with a concise description of the important information, if any, that they contain. Be careful how you proceed here. Your first instinct might be to follow the advice described in Part 2 about how to take notes on your reading assignments. Don't do this. It's overkill. For now, you should be content to follow the advice of David from Dartmouth, who recommends that you skim, skim, skim. Specifically, read through the source quickly. Every time you pass by an important definition, idea, or opinion that seems relevant to your thesis, jot down, on your computer or by hand, the page number and a quick description. For example, if the author argues a particular point of interest, write only what this point is. There is no need to also copy down the evidence he uses to support it as you would for notes on a reading assignment. If the source is a book, then, as Anna from Dartmouth explains, pick out only the chapters that relate to the specific aspect of the topic that you are interested in. It is not necessary to read the entire book. When you're finished, staple your annotations to your personal copy of the corresponding source. In general, proper source annotations should act as concise pointers, containing just enough information to show you where the relevant arguments are hiding. In the next step, where you organize all of your gathered information into a coherent structure, these simple annotations turn out to be exactly what you need to quickly assess the importance of each source. Therefore, you will end up needing to carefully read only the passages that help your paper. You should not think of this step as adding work. As you will soon discover, these concise annotations are actually going to save you a significant amount of time. 4. Decide if you're done. There is no simple answer to this question. While it would be nice to offer a perfect formula for how much research is enough, it is impossible. There are just too many variations to contend with. Some short papers might require dozens of sources, while some long tracts may focus entirely on a handful of original documents. What follows is a rough procedure that should aid your decision about whether or not you have gathered enough research. Remember, this is just an approximation. Always keep in mind the context of your specific assignment. However, this approach should help reduce the guesswork involved in completing this step. The research termination determination procedure. 1. List the topics, specific questions, facts, or accounts from your research that are crucial to support your thesis. 2. List the topics that might help you support your thesis. 3. If you have at least 2 good sources for each of the topics from number 1 and have at least 1 good source for a majority of the topics from number 2, then you're done. Otherwise, you need to keep researching. The reason these criteria are just an approximation is because at this early stage, you probably don't know exactly how your thesis argument will proceed, so you don't know exactly what information you need. This procedure simply helps you estimate as best you can. By separating out the crucial from the potentially helpful, you are less likely to get stuck hunting down an obscure piece of information that you could do without. This approach is advised by David from Dartmouth, who describes the following similar procedure for sorting his research sources. I make 3 piles of my sources, very useful, potentially useful, and not useful. To draw from our previous example, if your thesis deals with the Uyghur and Swiss cultural identity, you might construct your list of crucial and might help topics as follows. 1. Topics that are crucial to support the thesis. Basic historical information concerning the Uyghur, when it was discovered, when it was first climbed, and so forth. Arguments concerning Swiss cultural identity at the turn of the century. 2. Topics that might be helpful in supporting the thesis. Memoirs of people who were involved in the first ascents of the mountain. Press accounts from the time, both Swiss and non-Swiss. General discussions of the role of sports and national pride. If you have a hard time tracking down one of the topics from the second list, you would still be okay. If, on the other hand, you have a hard time tracking down either of the topics from the first list, then you need to keep looking. In the next step, where you actually begin to outline your paper, it's expected that you might need to return briefly to the research phase and find additional sources to fill in any holes. If you follow the procedure just described, however, you will minimize the amount of secondary research that you are forced to conduct, thus saving yourself from more hours in the library. Step 5. Craft a powerful story. This step is where the magic happens. It's the fun part of paper writing, the moment of intellectual eureka. You have already defined and verified a compelling thesis, and you have at your disposal a collection of well-organized and annotated research material. Now, it's time to stretch your mental muscles and pull these pieces together into a powerful story. As Anna from Dartmouth says, in order to write a great paper, you really need to make connections that other people haven't made, and the only way to do that is to think. This is the step where such thinking occurs. Formulate your argument. You must have a vision of what the overall structure of your paper will be, explains Frank, a straight-A student from Brown. Organization of thought can make a decently researched essay into a fine piece of academic work. Formulating a solid argument, however, cannot be reduced to a system. It is a mental exercise that requires critical thinking and creativity. At the college level, there is no set structure that allows you to fill in the blanks and automatically produce a smart paper. As mentioned in the opening to Part 3, the intro body conclusion nonsense introduced in high school won't do you any good here. It's too simplistic, and your professors will be expecting more. In general, a good college-level argument should accomplish the following. 1. Draw from previous work on the same topic to define the context for the discussion. 2. Introduce a thesis and carefully spell out how it relates to existing work on similar issues. 3. Support the thesis with careful reasoning and references to existing arguments, evidence, and primary sources. 4. Introduce some final prognostications about extending the argument and its potential impact on the field as a whole. There is, however, no set order or format for presenting these general points. One paper might start by defining the context and then move on to the thesis. Another paper might start with the thesis, argue it, and then introduce the broader context at the end. Many papers might interweave all 4 points. There is no right answer here. And the hard truth is that the only way to get better at organizing and presenting your thoughts is through practice. So write a lot and read good arguments a lot. This is the best recipe for developing your skills for this step. That being said, there are some general pointers about how to go about formulating your argument. These aren't rules for what to say, rather they are tips for how to get your brain fired up and your creative juices flowing. Tip number one. When it comes time to craft the storyline of your paper, put yourself in the right mindset. Grab a copy of Atlantic Monthly, The New Yorker, Harper's, or any other publication that features well-crafted discussions. Peruse some articles, and then go for a walk along a quiet path. Alternatively, as David from Dartmouth recommends, talk to friends. If they are good friends, they will allow you to bounce ideas off of them and talk through your work. You can also cloister yourself in a dusty, wooden-shelved, overstuffed, armchair-filled corner of the library, or argue with your professor during office hours. Reread related articles and chapters from your course syllabus. Watch a PBS documentary. Do whatever it takes to get the reasoning portions of your mind inspired and curious. Tip number two. At this point, grab your source material from the previous step. If your assignment is a critical analysis essay, this will consist of only a couple of books and your reading notes. If it's a research paper, you might have a large stack of photocopied chapters and articles. In either case, dive into this information and start letting the relevant facts and arguments settle into your mind. This is where your annotations will point you toward what's interesting and help you avoid the irrelevant. Tip number three, take a break. Do something else. Let the pieces float around in the background noise of your mind. The first thing I do when I have a paper to write is take a nap, explains Laura, a straight-A student from Dartmouth. I crawl into bed and just think. As long as I'm thinking about the subject when I fall asleep, I will dream about the material and usually come up with some sort of interesting idea. Similarly, start looking for any opportunity to do a little thinking about your argument. I think about my paper when I go around completing my daily chores, when I walk to class, or when I wait online in the dining hall, explains Anna from Dartmouth. Use this downtime to slide the pieces of your argument around in your head and play with the structure a bit. Keep returning to your research material as needed to find more details and to increase your understanding. You need to expose yourself to the source material again and again to fully internalize it. Only then can you really pull together the best possible argument. Constructing an outline. You need an outline to capture the argument you just spent so much time devising. Keep in mind, however, that all outlines are not created equal. In fact, there are two major outline-related mistakes made by students. First, under-outlining. If your outline lacks enough detail, it's not going to serve its purpose as a structure to guide your writing, and you will end up writing from scratch. You want to avoid this at all costs. It leads to argumentative dead ends and weak structure overall. In high school, I wrote all my papers in one go, starting with the intro, constructing and polishing each sentence in order, explains Christine from Harvard. In college, I've become a huge fan of outline-based writing, which has made my essays much more tightly argued and given them better, clearer trajectories. Since I can now shuffle topics around until they flow with some natural order and logic, rather than straining rhetorically to bridge from one idea to another. The second mistake, over-outlining. Some students construct beautifully intricate outlines, replete with three or four levels of information, Roman numerals, digits, letters, and tabs flying everywhere. The type of outline they taught you to make for your fifth grade research project. Don't do this either. It constrains you. As Doris from Harvard explains, one pitfall to avoid is getting stuck in the outline stage. I've seen students who spend far too much time embellishing their outlines when they should really have begun writing the paper itself long ago. When it comes time to write, you will be hampered if you constructed an outline that practically spells out what each sentence of each paragraph should say. These sorts of low-level decisions should be made when you write, not before. It's not until you're actually putting words on paper that you will understand the best way to make each small piece of your argument flow. Don't let an outline make these decisions for you. The happy medium between these two extremes is to construct a topic-level outline. Before we can cover the specifics of this process, I must first define what I mean by topic. Here I use the term to describe any self-contained point that you might discuss in your paper. Typically, this is something more general than a piece of evidence, but also more specific than a multi-part argument. For example, here are some sample topics for our hypothetical paper about the Eiger. Our thesis about the Eiger and Swiss cultural identity, early written accounts of the Eiger, the first ascent of the Eiger, contemporary press accounts of Eiger summit attempts, mentions of the Eiger in early 20th century popular culture, mentions of the Eiger in early 20th century Swiss tourist brochures, Macmillan's thesis about the Alps and European identity, the relationship between our thesis and Macmillan's argument, concluding thoughts about our thesis, implications, and future work. We start the outlining process by constructing a topic skeleton. This is a list of all the topics you will discuss in your paper, presented in the order that you plan to include them. Type this list directly into your computer because you will later need the ability to insert text in between items. Your topic skeleton succinctly describes the structure of your argument. For example, we might take the previously mentioned topics and order them as follows to form a topic skeleton for our hypothetical Eiger paper. 1. Mentions of the Eiger in early 20th century Swiss tourist brochures. 2. Macmillan's thesis about the Alps and European identity. 3. Our thesis about the Eiger and Swiss cultural identity. 4. Early written accounts of the Eiger. 5. The first ascent of the Eiger. 6. Contemporary press accounts of Eiger summit attempts. 7. Mentions of the Eiger in early 20th century popular culture. 8. The relationship between our thesis and Macmillan's argument. 9. Concluding thoughts about our thesis, implications, and future work. At this point, no specific pieces of evidence are described by our outline, but it does capture how the paper will flow. In a perfect world, you would have at least one or two good sources to support each topic. However, it will often occur that as you formulate your topic skeleton, you come across a topic that you really need to include, but for which you don't yet have any sources. That's okay. We mentioned at the end of the last step that once you start formulating your argument, you might come across some holes that need to be filled. This is exactly where these holes will become noticeable. Once you have completed your topic skeleton, you need to return to the previous step and find sources to support any of the currently unsupported topics. If you followed the research termination determination procedure from before, there shouldn't be too many of these holes. Filling in the details of your topic outline. Once you finish your topic skeleton and find sources for all of the unsupported topics, it's time to fill in the supporting details. This next step is crucial. As Christine from Harvard explains, below each bold header in my topic skeleton, I compile in regular typeface the evidence pertaining to that header. You should actually type quotes from your research material right into the word processor document containing the outline and label each quote with the source and page that it came from. For example, under the First Ascent of the Eiger topic, you might insert quotes from a few different books on the mountain as well as excerpts from several contemporary articles. Some of these latter excerpts may also be included under the Contemporary Press Accounts of Eiger Summit Attempts topic. It's okay to share information between topics at this point, since you will sort out which quote to use where once the writing process begins. This is not a time for caution. If it seems relevant, stick it in. At first, this step may sound excessive. By the time you finish, your outline will be large and filled with quotes, perhaps even longer than the projected length of your completed paper. Fortunately, this process is greatly simplified by the format of your gathered research materials. Because you made a personal copy of and annotated every source, finding the appropriate pieces of evidence to include in your outline will be much easier than if you had to page through each book and article from scratch. Furthermore, the benefits of this outline far outweigh the annoyance of constructing it. As Robert, a straight-A student from Brown, explains, I find that using this process helps me avoid digging through a pile of books and articles for each piece of information I need as I need it during writing. Remember, the goal of the straight A approach is to separate the different components of paper construction. When it comes time to write, you don't want to be flipping through your sources, hunting down the right support. This drains your energy, increases your pain, takes time, and reduces the quality of your writing. This is why it is crucial that you extract the information from your sources in advance. Later, the writing process will be reduced to the much simpler task of simply building a framework around this already identified and organized information structure. Step 6. Consult your expert panel. I discuss ideas with friends, says Suzanne, a straight-A student from Brown, and am therefore usually pretty confident with my argument by the time I sit down to write. Suzanne reinforces a key observation. The more input you receive, the better your paper will turn out. And because soliciting advice is easy, you might as well get your outline reviewed by a group of people you trust. In the straight-A lexicon, this strategy is called consulting your expert panel. The technique is popular because it requires little effort on your part, but the impact on your paper quality is significant. This is the final push that transforms your thinking from interesting into compelling, and your paper from competent into a standout. Choosing your expert panel. The size of your expert panel should be directly proportional to the importance of the assignment. If it's a one-page essay worth 5% of your grade, then your expert panel should consist of only yourself. If it's a medium-size, critical analysis essay, you might aim for two opinions. If it's a major term paper worth a significant portion of your grade, then you may want to solicit feedback from as many as half a dozen well-chosen people. Who should sit on your panel? Your number one pick should be your professor. Unless he specifically states that he won't discuss drafts in progress, which professors sometimes do to avoid an overload of conferencing in a large class, definitely plan to bring your outline to office hours. Lay out the general shape of your argument and the types of sources you are drawing from and where. More often than not, the professor will have some targeted advice on how to better present your points. He might suggest a new order or an added topic that should be addressed. As David from Dartmouth notes, this meeting also will help you to create a rapport with the prof and give you an idea of what he or she is looking for. Yes, you've already talked with your professor in step 3, seek a second opinion. Don't worry. There is nothing wrong with talking to a professor on two separate occasions for one paper. The first conference was quick and dealt with making sure you were starting off in the right direction. This second conference is more detailed, making sure that you manage to stay on course. Keep in mind that some students talk to their professors many times during the paper writing process, perhaps once or twice a week. This is overkill and shouldn't be necessary if you followed the efficient strategy laid out in this book. But rest assured that two visits are hardly monopolizing your professor's time. In addition to your professor, as David also suggests, if you have smart friends, get their help too. Friends from the same class are your best bet since they will already understand the constraints of the assignment. If you aren't close with any classmates, then tap a friend with a compatible academic background. For example, if your paper is for a history class, it makes more sense to talk to a liberal arts major than an engineering major. The former will be more familiar with this style of paper. Pick a half-hour period to sit down with each friend you choose. Explain your thesis, and then run through your outline, touching on your main supporting arguments. Your friends will help you identify pieces of your structure that are unclear or unnecessary. As Jason, a straight-A student from the University of Pennsylvania, explains, if you can explain why your argument works in a rational step-by-step manner, and you have an arsenal of sources to cite to support the argument, then you're ready to go. One final warning. Before discussing with a classmate, make sure that collaboration of this sort is allowed. It should be no problem for research papers, but for focused critical analysis essays, the professor may specifically forbid that you discuss your response with other people from the class. Step 7. Write without the agony. If you've followed the straight A strategy so far, writing should be the most straightforward part of constructing a standout paper. This step is not mysterious. At this point, you know what to say and in what order, so all you have to do is clearly communicate your already well-developed argument. "Once I have the outline, my brain relaxes," explains Jeremy, a straight A student from Dartmouth. "I don't need to think anymore about structuring the paper, but rather just think about how to best articulate my thoughts." Note, however, that this book is not about the mechanics of writing. This is a skill that you will need to develop on your own. In general, the more you write outside of class, the better. So, to improve your skills, try to write as much as you can. Also, don't be afraid to plunk a Chicago Manual of Style above your desk or flip through well-known style guides like William Zinsser's On Writing Well. These can help you focus and polish your writing, and professors appreciate clear exposition. This being said, there is not much left to cover. You know what you have to do: put words on paper. It's not easy, but if you followed the previous steps, it won't be nearly as agonizing as most students make it. I leave you with only three succinct pieces of logistical advice to help guide you through the process of combining your writing skills with your straight A preparation to produce the best possible paper. Separate your writing from the steps that come before and after. As Greta, a straight A student from Dartmouth, explains, when it comes to the writing process, she would map out a schedule, for example, write 2 pages a day for 5 days and then edit 1 day. Ryan, another Dartmouth student, admits that he usually gave about 2 days for the actual writing, but the research part of the paper usually happened a few weeks before. Both of these students' habits are instructed by a simple rule: separate your research from your writing and your writing from your editing. Of course, this is not always practical for a small critical analysis essay, but it's crucial for a more substantial research paper. A fresh mind produces better results. It's hard to write well when you've spent an exhausting morning researching in the library. It's equally as hard to edit carefully when you have already spent hours that day writing the words you were about to review. Having time away from the paper, explains Jeremy from Dartmouth, allows you to come at it with better concentration. Write in quiet isolation. Writing requires substantial concentration. If you work in an area with a lot of ambient noise, you will become distracted and your efficiency will decrease dramatically. Therefore, if you have a laptop, retreat to a distant, silent corner of a faraway building to work on your writing. "I am most productive," explains Suzanne from Brown, "in a place where I have total silence and no external stimulation. For example, the library stacks." As I emphasized in part one of this book, avoid, if possible, study lounges, crowded areas of the library, and public computer labs. These places are noisy, and as Riel from Brown warns, you're always running into people and getting snagged by fascinating conversations. If you don't have a laptop, then work at the computer in your room at times when your roommates are in class or at meetings. If necessary, arrange in advance to kick them out for a few hours so you can work in peace. In addition, you should schedule your writing to correspond to your energetic high points during the day. For me, this meant working right after breakfast with my first cup of coffee. For others, this might be the early evening, right before dinner, or the afternoon after a post-lunch workout. The key is to recognize that writing is perhaps the most demanding, in terms of focus required, intellectual activity you will do while a college student. More so than reading, solving problem sets, or studying, writing demands all the energy and focus that you can manage. Follow your outline and move slowly. Chris from Dartmouth offers simple advice for tackling the writing process. "I use the outline I've created as a guide and just sort of build from that, taking it one paragraph at a time." Follow this example. Use your outline to direct your writing. Setting up and expounding on each of the topics in a clear, cogent way, and copying and pasting quotes directly into your paper wherever needed. Keep your attention focused on the topic at hand. Your mind is free from concerns of structure and sources at this point, so you can concentrate on articulating specific points clearly and strongly. Always make sure your current point reads clearly before moving on to the next. Some students have success by writing their first draft quickly and sloppily and then returning to clean it up in many successive editing rounds. In your case, however, because you're working from a detailed topic outline, it will end up being quicker to write carefully the first time. Moving fast tends to produce time-consuming dead ends later on and ultimately necessitates major rewrites. And, believe it or not, that's all you need to know. So stop fearing writing. If you follow this system, this step, though still challenging, won't take an excessive amount of time. Leave the all-nighters to the average students. Get your first draft done quickly and effectively, and then go have some fun. Step 8. Fix. Don't fixate. Editing your paper is important, and this shouldn't come as a surprise. If you hand in pages containing spelling and grammatical mistakes, the professor will be more than disappointed. She's likely to lower your grade as a result. Even if your argument is brilliant, it's really hard to get past those simple errors. This last step of the paper writing process aims to free your work of these imperfections. At the same time, however, you don't want to over-edit. Many students fixate on these fixes and end up devoting hours to reviewing draft after draft. This act of academic self-flagellation is especially prevalent when working on big research papers. After all the work you dedicate to crafting a masterpiece of an argument, you begin to fear letting your baby out into the world. It's sort of like suffering from a nerdy version of Stockholm Syndrome, and it's a drag. You can edit a paper forever and still not be satisfied, explains Frank from Brown. So it's important to know when to just print the damn thing out and send it off to its fate. The goal here is to devise a simple system, something you can follow for every paper to help you root out the embarrassing typos and confusing constructions, but also to prevent you from becoming a grammar psycho. Drawing from the advice given in my straight A interviews, I present in this step a system that meets these criteria. It involves three simple passes through your draft, no more and no less. For those of you who are used to endless editing runs, the idea that three passes is enough might sound suspiciously quick, or if you're the kind of person whose idea of proofreading is hitting the spell check button, multiple runs might seem hopelessly time-consuming. But rest assured, the system is efficient, and it gets the job done. As we will soon discuss, the key is the specific kind of attention given to each pass. Here is how it works. The argument adjustment pass. Your first pass through your work should be conducted on your computer. Read carefully and focus on the presentation of your arguments. Don't worry about small grammatical mistakes for the moment. Take in the paper one paragraph at a time. If a section is awkwardly stated, clarify the sentences. If it makes a point you already explained earlier, ruthlessly cut it out. If the argument is lacking detail, add in more sentences as necessary to fully explain your point. If a transition is lacking between topics or paragraphs, add one. Also, be on the lookout for any major structural issues. Sometimes you don't realize until you finish an entire draft that your topic outline wasn't optimal. Don't be afraid to shift around major chunks of text. This is your chance to make serious edits to the structure of your paper, so take this seriously. Do this editing at a time when you are rested and unhurried by upcoming appointments. For a large paper, spread this pass out over several days if possible. When you're done, your paper may still contain small mistakes. That's okay, you'll fix those next. The goal here is to tweak the argument until you're satisfied that it makes every point that you want to make in the order that you want to make them. Once you're done with this pass, these big picture details are locked in. The out loud pass. The argument adjustment pass is important, but not sufficient by itself. As Robert from Brown explains, my papers always read differently on the page than on the screen. And as Melanie, a straight-A Dartmouth student, adds, having a hard copy to read and mark up was absolutely necessary. Accordingly, for this next pass, you should first print out a copy of your paper and then take it where you can have some privacy. With a pencil in hand, and this is the important part, begin to read your paper out loud. Don't cheat. Use a strong voice and articulate each word as if you're delivering a speech. For a long paper, it may take a long time to read the entire thing, so be prepared to split this into several sessions. You might also want water or hot tea on hand to prevent you from losing your voice. Whatever you do, however, don't avoid actually articulating every word. Whereas the last pass focused on your arguments, the goal of this pass is to root out small mistakes that might otherwise distract a reader from your engaging thesis. While reading, whenever you come across a grammatical mistake or an awkward construction, mark it clearly on the printout. Then go back up to the beginning of the preceding paragraph and start reading again. After you have marked up the entire document, go back to your computer and enter the changes you noted on your printout. A word of warning. This process always takes longer than expected, so leave yourself plenty of time. The rationale behind this approach is simple. As Ryan from Dartmouth explains, reading it out loud helps you catch typos or strange wording better than reading it in your head. No matter how many times you review a draft, if you're scanning silently, there are certain awkward phrases you might skip over every time. Our subconscious minds have a habit of patching over these mistakes when reading our own writing. When you say the words out loud, on the other hand, your ear will catch even minor problems and draw your attention to them. Something that looks fine on paper will jump out as strange or poorly worded when you hear it, explains Jeremy from Dartmouth. Therefore, by reading the paper out loud, you will catch most mistakes in your paper in just one pass, requiring much less time than the multiple silent reviews necessary to achieve similar results. The sanity pass. Because the previous passes were so careful, you're almost done. And you've only read through your work twice so far. Just to be sure that something embarrassing didn't slip through, it's a good idea to make a final, quick pass through a printed copy of your paper before handing it in. You don't have to do this pass out loud, and feel free to move through it quickly, but definitely use a printed copy rather than reading on your computer screen, since a hard copy has a better chance of revealing a typo. If possible, separate this pass from the previous two. In fact, it's fine to do this the morning of the deadline. At this point, there should be no major mistakes lurking in your document. The goal here is twofold. First, as mentioned, this last pass catches stray mistakes. I tried to always reread my papers before handing them in, explains James, a straight-A student from Dartmouth. I try to smooth out any last kinks in the flow during that final editing. Second, and perhaps more important, it also provides closure on your paper. Because your work is so polished by this point, this final read-through should essentially go smoothly. As a result, you will develop a better feel for the flow and enjoy the experience of watching your argument unfold. This should help put your mind at ease. After all your work, think of this last pass as your reward. A final review before the paper leaves your hands, probably never to be read by you again. That's why we call it a sanity pass. Once you hand in your paper, you can now confidently tell yourself, unless I'm going insane here, I'm pretty sure that I just handed in a damn good piece of writing. The plan in action. As in part two, we end our discussion with a pair of detailed case studies that show you how to put the straight A system into practice. One focuses on a research paper, whereas the other focuses on a critical analysis essay. Notice how the students in the following case studies adapt the system to the demands of each assignment, and in both cases, pay attention to how our system reduces the time required for writing, the step most students unfoundedly fear above all others. Case study number one, Mindy's art history research paper. Mindy's class on early American art doesn't have a final exam. This was, not surprisingly, an important motivation in her decision to register for this particular subject. But now, as the end of the term approaches, Mindy realizes her joy was premature. In place of the final exam, she must instead write a truly intimidating research paper, a 30 to 50 page colossus that is worth half of her final grade. The subject matter is wide open. The paper can cover any topic regarding any American artist before the modern period. The professor has made it clear that he expects a large and well-considered argument from each student. He warns the class to start early and work hard. Last-minute efforts will be easily identified and graded with a punitive abandon. Monday, 1 month before the due date. With a month to go until the deadline, Mindy decides it's time to initiate the early stages of the straight-A process. She has no intention of beginning serious researching or writing at this point. It's too early for that. Instead, she's simply kicking off the non-demanding thinking phase of the paper process. Choosing a topic, finding a thesis idea, and then getting a second opinion on the idea from her professor. For her first step, Mindy spends a half hour Monday night flipping through her class notes, trying to find a topic that piques her interest. Without too much searching, she comes across something promising. Early in the course, when they were studying the American expatriate painter Washington Allston, the professor made a comment about some similarities between Allston's paintings and those of German artist Caspar David Friedrich. The connection was interesting because, as far as the professor knew, the two painters had never met. Mindy had jotted down this comment in her notes along with a little exclamation point. Perhaps this mysterious connection would make for a good topic? Mindy will have to conduct a thesis hunting expedition to find out for sure, but it's a good start. Wednesday, 3 weeks and 5 days to the due date. Mindy has set aside a couple of hours to lurk in the library and seek out an interesting thesis relating to her topic idea. She starts with the card catalog and soon finds some monographs that focus entirely on Allston's career. She is able to locate two of these books amid the stacks and then settles into a nearby study carrel to go through them. For the first hour, she chooses one of the titles and begins to read it. This helps her build a better understanding of Allston's background and the significance of his career. She realizes, however, that it will be too time-consuming for her to continue trying to read the entire book, so she next flips straight to the index. She hits pay dirt in the index of one of the two books, an entry for Caspar David Friedrich. Flipping to that page, she sees a quick one-sentence note about how some author, whose name she doesn't recognize, has posited a connection between Allston and Friedrich. Mindy looks up the reference connected to this sentence and finds the title of an obscure book about philosophy and the early Romantic artists. She finds the call number for this new book and dives back into the stacks to find it. Success! The old manuscript has a chapter devoted to Allston and Friedrich. In fact, it goes so far as to compare two of their paintings and offer an explanation for the similarities. Mindy makes a photocopy of this chapter and labels it with the information she will need to later cite the book. She leaves the library with her personal copy of this key source in hand. Friday, 3 weeks and 3 days to the due date. Mindy's art history professor has office hours on Friday afternoons. This is a perfect opportunity for Mindy to seek a second opinion on her thesis idea. The problem, however, is that she doesn't yet have a fully formed idea. For now, she is stuck with only an intriguing topic. With this in mind, she sets aside an hour in the morning to read through her personal copy of the source she found in the library earlier in the week. Her hope is to develop some interesting ideas before office hours that afternoon. This careful review gives Mindy a better understanding of the author's argument. Fortunately, it's focused. The author looks at a painting by each artist, and then he gives a concise and specific philosophical rationale for both. This focus is fortunate because it leaves a lot of room for Mindy to extend the argument, even though she's not yet sure what this extension will entail. She recognizes that making a well-considered but constrained addition to an already established argument is a great way to develop a meaningful but manageable research paper thesis. During lulls in class that day, Mindy continues to mull over her topic, trying to find a good direction for her thesis. Finally, as the bell rings, an insight hits her. The source she found had explained a shared philosophy between Allston and Friedrich, but it did nothing to explain why they both followed this philosophy. If Mindy can find a common source for the artists' shared philosophical interests, then that could make for a fascinating argument. Arriving at office hours later that afternoon, Mindy explains her thesis idea to her professor. The key word here is idea. She does not yet know if this direction will bear fruit. It's possible that her research would turn up no information that helps explain the shared philosophical interests between the two artists. So there is, as is often the case with an engaging thesis idea, an element of risk at this early stage. By meeting with her professor, however, Mindy can greatly reduce this risk. That's a major reason why this step is so important. A professor can draw from his deep pool of knowledge and experience with a topic and generate a reasonable hunch as to whether or not a specific idea seems promising, potentially preventing a frustrating dead end. Fortunately for Mindy, her professor likes the thesis. To him, it seems likely that Mindy can find some evidence for a connection, and he points her towards some well-known Alston and Friedrich monographs that might help her investigation. Sunday, 3 weeks and 1 day to the due date. Mindy makes another journey to the library, armed with the book suggestions she received from her professor. Using a well-stocked iPod to abate her boredom, she seeks out two of these books, one for each artist, and makes personal copies of the relevant chapters of each. This takes a good hour to complete, but the work is mindless, so it's not that bad. Later that evening, Mindy takes these newly acquired personal copies to one of her favorite isolated study spots. She begins to skim through and annotate each. She's not exactly sure what she's looking for, but she knows the more information she has found, copied, and labeled, the better off she will be. Over time, she begins to notice a name that keeps popping up in her Alston book, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, a young European writer and thinker who seemed to have a big impact on Alston. Mindy hopes to find a mention of Coleridge in the Friedrich material, but she comes up empty-handed. This doesn't dissuade her, however. Friedrich, as it turns out, was hanging around several European philosophical circles at the time. It would not be surprising if there were some sort of connection to Coleridge through one of them. Her interest piqued, Mindy fires up the library webpage. In class, the professor had shown them a journal database that allows you to search for journal articles relating to art history. Mindy navigates to this page and begins searching, using queries that include both Friedrich and Coleridge. After some sifting through the results, she finds what she is looking for, an article about Friedrich and a group of artists he worked with in Germany. In the abstract for this article, it's mentioned that Coleridge was among the philosophers whose work inspired the group. A connection has been found. Mindy prints the article and records on the first page all the information she needs to later cite it. Monday to Sunday, 3 weeks to the due date. Excited by her find, Mindy emails her professor to explain her newly developed Coleridge as the missing link thesis. He loves it and gives her some advice on what sort of additional evidence would help make the case compelling. With an approved thesis in hand and a good idea of what additional sources she'll need to form a strong argument, Mindy can now lay out a rough schedule for the steps that follow. Over the next week, she will continue to research. Then she will spend the following week crafting her story, building an outline, and getting some final feedback on the argument. This will leave her exactly 1 week to turn a detailed topic outline into a few dozen pages of coherent writing. The schedule is reasonable in that it doesn't require work every day, and it rarely requires more than a couple hours on any given day. Thus, the construction of her paper can be easily woven into her already busy schedule. Following the straight-A approach, Mindy's week of research proceeds mechanically. At each trip to library, on average, Mindy spends 1 or 2 hours, during which she finds 2 or 3 sources. Each source gets copied, labeled, and annotated. She makes these trips 3 times during the week and once on Sunday, leaving her with a significant stack of annotated material. Remember, at this point, very little thinking has been dedicated to how all of these pieces will fit together into the final paper. That's for the next step. Monday to Sunday, 2 weeks to the due date. Now comes the fun part. In one hand, Mindy has a compelling thesis. In the other hand, she has a stack of annotated personal copies of sources relating to the thesis. Now she has to figure out how to combine the two into a believable story. There is no mechanical solution to this problem. It requires some serious thinking. And this is exactly what Mindy does. Over the course of this week, she takes a lot of walks around campus to consider her argument